Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Our founding fathers gathered in taverns to enjoy lively political conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio, today coming to you from Theater Cedar Rapids. I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Erin Jordan.
And we have our panelists on stage here at Theater Cedar Rapids. Erin, would you do the honors?
Yes, we've got Todd Dorman, Gazette Opinion and Insights Editor, Linda Waddington, Gazette Columnist, James Lynch, Gazette Political Reporter, and Adam Sullivan, Gazette Columnist.
Okay, what do we want to start with, Erin?
Well, I would like to start with what's happening in the House of Representatives.
Let's do that.
Yeah, all right. So this week, the House Judiciary Committee voted to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress for not releasing the full Mueller report. I wanted to ask the panel, I mean, do you think the full House will pass this? And what, if anything, does it mean for Barr?
I think the House will pass it. What it means for Barr, I'm not sure, because nobody really knows what will happen after this. They, you know, they're constitutionally, I guess, they can arrest him. There's a House jail that they could hold him in, although that apparently is not the case anymore, if there ever was a jail. It's not really clear that it's going to affect Barr if they vote to hold him in contempt. He's not the first attorney general to be held in contempt. It's the optics are good for House Democrats. It certainly signals that they're serious about pursuing these investigations and pursuing them, you know, seeing the Mueller report. Whether it works for them, I don't know. It's too soon.
I do understand, you know, since Steve King doesn't have those committee assignments, I hear that he's filling in as bailiff at the House jail.
He could totally do that.
Well, We had both Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler, the House Judiciary Committee chair, say this week that it has arrived. We are now in a constitutional crisis. That is the quote from Nancy Pelosi. We've talked about it for over a year, as far as I can tell. What does it feel like to be in a constitutional crisis? What is a constitutional crisis? Is it that the framework set out by our founding fathers is being tested, is being defied, is what? What is our constitutional crisis, and what do we expect in the coming months to be hopefully resolved in this crisis?
You know, I think generally a constitutional crisis is when you have something the Constitution doesn't necessarily directly address. So you kind of have Congress wanting to do one thing, you have the executive branch wanting to do another, and we're kind of sitting here in limbo waiting for the judicial branch to chime in and tell us what's going to happen. So I don't know necessarily that we have reached constitutional crisis yet. I think we might have more differences of interpretation than a lack of documentation on what should be going on.
Well, we've sort of been in an ordinary crisis now, and this is we've stepped into a new level of crisisness. And I think that's, so, I mean, we've got that going for us.
It's like when you think the opera singer has reached her highest note,
yeah,
and then there's still a higher note yet.
I mean, most amplifiers only go to 10. We're going to 11.
All right.
It seems exceedingly unlikely that the president or even the attorney general would be, like, removed from power in any way, but the president is not acting like an innocent person necessarily. I think if you didn't do anything wrong, I think you would want people to read the full report, and then your folks could respond to that. If you think Mueller, you know, wrote things wrong, he could respond to that. He has that ability, and so the real resolution to this is the next election, the next federal election next year, and who knows what happens. I gave up on predicting that last time around when I was really, really wrong. But I think there's legitimate arguments about whether there should be impeachment proceedings or whether there should be this or that legal maneuver, but really, you know, the people have a say next November, and I think that's what it'll probably come down to.
Along the lines of the election, it seems like the Democratic presidential candidates are maybe walking a tightrope a little bit about what they think should be done with the Mueller report. How would you express what you've seen from those candidates and who seems to be doing the best job with that?
I think you have to separate the members, the candidates who are members of the House and Senate and those that aren't. I think if you're not a member of the House or Senate right now, I guess I don't think people should really care what you think about impeachment, because if all goes accordingly, you'll be the next president and impeachment won't matter. But I think that it is an opportunity for the ones who do serve in the Congress to, you know, stake out a position. Nothing really sticks out to me as far as people who have done a really bad job of it, though.
I think the people who are on the Senate Judiciary Committee probably have an advantage. Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, for example, because they had an opportunity to question Barr and so sort of prosecute the issue. So I think they have a leg up on other people. I don't know that anybody's done a bad job. I'm not sure you could do a bad job.
Huh. Well, if you poll the whole country, then you see polling that shows that most people don't one impeachment, but of course, if you ask the Democratic base, the people who are going to be deciding the nomination, there's a lot more support for impeachment. So that's where they're stuck, is do you advocate for something that perhaps the larger electorate thinks is a bad idea, but that the voters you're trying to win the nomination really, really want you to do that? Because they look at the Mueller report and they say, this guy shouldn't be able to get away with this without some sort of consequence. And that this is one of the only consequences at their disposal.
But curiously enough, we have the Democratic base, those in favor of impeachment, according to Nancy Pelosi, on the same side as Donald Trump. Because Nancy Pelosi says Donald Trump is goading the Democrats into an impeachment process because it will be good for his base. So he is in line with the Democratic base, right?
He knew exactly how much obstruction of justice to perfectrate. It was perfect. It was a perfect plan.
I don't think there's any doubt that Donald Trump deserves to be impeached. I think the question that we're debating is whether the nation deserves to go through impeachment proceedings,
which won't result in a removal.
Right.
Right. And nothing will get done while impeachment proceedings are going on, which is the problem we've had for at least the last 2 years, that nothing is getting done other than people fighting over whether we're going to investigate, who we're going to investigate, and how we're going to do it. And certainly Congress has an oversight role that it should fulfill, but it needs to walk and chew gum at the same time, and it really hasn't demonstrated, whether when it was under Republican control and now under Democratic control in the House, that it can do that.
Right. It will dominate the legislative agenda, the congressional agenda, but also we have 2020 candidates out there. Boy, do we know it here in Iowa. It will tend to dominate discussion. Bernie Sanders has aired, his worries about this. If we're only talking about Trump, and impeachment, we are not talking about health care. We are not talking about a standard minimum wage. We are not talking about some of the things, the issues that most people think we should be voting on issues. I guess the power of the presidency, co-equal branches of government, is an issue in itself.
Well, and Linda's right that if the president is goading Democrats into beginning impeachment proceedings, I think it works in his favor, because it really fires up his base as well as the Democratic base, and it probably won't result in anything other. I mean, even if they approve, the articles of impeachment, if the House approves that, it's not going to go anywhere. And the president will use it to his advantage politically to fire up his base, to raise money. And I'm sure he'll, cast himself as the victim here.
Well, he feeds on conflict and division, and there's no larger conflict in our federal system than impeachment. And there'll be no more divisive topic than that. So, for folks who think the Democrats' best chance is to have an election that's about the future of the country and the vision that they have on issues, and the worst thing that can happen is that it's all about Trump and his victimization, and it will help him if he's impeached. But it's such a difficult question, because on the other hand, you read the Mueller report, he did things that it's really hard to just sort of shrug them off. And that's
700 former federal prosecutors agree with
right,
you, Todd.
Right.
Just to clarify, I think that the reason that this is such a hot topic, I think, is largely attributable to some segment of the national media. From what I see, the presidential candidates will respond to questions about this, but I don't think that a lot of them are necessarily making this their main talking point. Right. I think about somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who I really don't agree with on much of anything, but to her credit, she's putting out really detailed big policy ideas. I don't see her volunteering to talk about impeachment or anything like that. I think a lot of these candidates actually want to talk about the issues, and I think a lot of voters want to. I think a lot of the local and regional media want to talk about the issues, but there's some segment of the national blogosphere and the TV news that really wants to focus on this impeachment thing. So I don't necessarily blame the candidates for that.
The biggest test for Trump will be coming up with a new description. I mean, if the Mueller report was a witch hunt, what's impeachment? How do you top that?
Well, also a new branding.
What's a coup? Isn't that what
coup,
they've been talking about as a coup?
He ran as the deal maker, the Midas touch on business. We saw the results of the New York Times investigation there. Does that change anything? Can he run on that same brand as the deal maker?
Well, he made a lot of deals, and he's still standing.
Are you going to believe the failing New York Times?
Yeah. I mean, for people who really thought he was a successful businessman and very astute, maybe it'll make some difference. But, he lost $1 billion, and he's still president.
If you've just joined us, listening to the broadcast, it's Pints and Politics edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, partnering up with the Gazette, listening there to Linda Waddington, James Lynch, Aaron Jordan, my co-host here, Adam Sullivan, and who did I forget? Todd Dorman.
Still here.
I wanted to talk about a little bit about electability. James, you mentioned that word, which has been in the news a lot. The idea that when people talk about electable, they talk, it's kind of pointing toward white men, it seems like. Do you think that that's going to be a roadblock in terms of uniting Democrats? If you've got people saying, well, this is just what we've always had versus, well, we want someone electable or we want someone who can beat Trump.
Probably. I mean, there are people in the party, and like I said, electability means different things to different people. Some people look at electability and say it's issues. Elizabeth Warren has great detail in her policy issues. Some people look at electability as someone who comes from something other than a white male demographic. Reaching out to people of color, people outside the Beltway. For some people, electability is more of a traditional measure of who can reach people beyond their base, who might get independent, might get even Republican votes. So, I mean, it means different things to different people, but there's the historical argument for Joe Biden, for example, somebody who's been there, has the experience. He's the white male. I'm not sure how important that is, given this field of Democratic candidates, since each one of them is getting some support within the party. Maybe the question is who can get support outside the party.
I think you're right for some people that electability is a stand-in for those identity politics things, but the top two biggest vote getters in American history are a woman and a black man, so that breaks down on those levels. And electability is I think it's a pseudoscience because presidential elections happen every 4 years. There's only a few dozen in our history, and that is not nearly a big enough sample size to make meaningful conclusions the way that political forecasters need to. And so I say just throw that out the window. If you like somebody because they're relatable, I think you need to recognize that that's a very personal thing to you. That person's not going to be relatable or personable or electable to everybody else. And so I say just go vote for the person who you think can do the job and who identifies with your values. And if everybody did that, I think we'd be in a much better place.
You have especially a lot of female reporters that are talking about this issue with electability. And that's largely because we have a Joe Biden. We have a Pete Buttigieg. We have a lot of men who don't have the experience and the depth of the women who are in the field, but those men continue to get more media time, more mentions than the women who are out there. And when that happens, the folks who are doing it immediately turn to electability. Well, because they've raised $10 more than this person, or because they served in this position. But what it really comes down to is that a lot of the media is male-driven, and like likes like. So if you have a panel of all male folks, generally speaking, they're going to gravitate toward the male. And, you know, when I talked about this in my column, I advocated for each woman in the audience to stand up and be the media they want to see, because that's what it's going to come to. And there's such a huge platform in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada that there's no reason that those networks can't be built right now to push back against that. So I would encourage you, if you're seeing this and you don't like these electability talks, to go out there and do what you can to change the focus.
Well, we had when Barack Obama in 2007 was a candidate, that was launched at him. We would not elect a black man to be president. Also, I remember Donald Trump in the early, he was treated as a joke and seen by the Republican Party, Jeb Bush, namely, as not electable. I guess you're not electable until you are. You're not deemed electable until you are.
If you look at Barack Obama and Donald Trump, and what you said about them is true, I don't know what more evidence you need that electability is not a real thing, or that at least that the media is really bad at assessing it.
Right.
Sometimes electability means what worked last time,
right,
not necessarily what's going to work next time. And so I think, you know, sometimes we have to kind of take electability with a grain of salt, or at least sort of step back and say, really, what does this mean? Because, yeah, what worked last time isn't going to work this time.
2020 is not only going to be terribly interesting over the next few months because of the campaign, the primary caucusing for presidential candidates, but also because of the congressional races. Let's focus on a couple of those with new developments here in Iowa. This week, the former 3rd District Congressman David Young, defeated by the Democrat Cindy Axne in 2018, announced he will run to reclaim that seat in 2020. He was elected in 2014. He served two terms. Iowa's 3rd District, just so we're all clear, southwest Iowa, including Des Moines and Council Bluffs, those areas. Voter registration, nearly equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats. Axne narrowly edging out Young in 2018, 49% of the vote to 47%. It amounted to a difference of about 5,000 votes. What are your thoughts on the 3rd District race coming up? David Young will be the nominee now that he's declared? We don't know that,
no.
Or do we, Adam?
He wasn't even supposed to be the nominee when he was the nominee. Did he get fourth or fifth and then was nominated at convention? So he'll definitely be able to raise more money than everybody else, but I don't see any hunger for that. And also, you know, presidential years in general are going to tend to be better for Democrats than off years. And so if you couldn't beat Cindy Axne in an off year, how could you possibly do it in a presidential year? I have no idea what he's doing.
And I think what I found most interesting about the 3rd District is that you also had, is it an Iowa House or a Senate member? Nunn?
Nunn? Nunn, he's in the Senate.
Zach,
yeah.
Nunn is doing a listening tour, as if an exploratory committee for Congress, in other words. So I don't know how much David Young's decision was communicated even within his own party.
Well, Young made his announcement, I think, the day that Zach Nunn kicked off his listening tour, so somebody was listening. you know, it's possible that David Young can win that seat back, but history isn't on his side. The Smart Politics blog looked at election records, and it's been 50 years since a defeated Iowa congressman has won back their seat. So 50 years ago it happened, but it hasn't happened since then. So yeah, I agree with Adam that it's going to be tough in a presidential election year when turnout is likely to be higher for David Young to recapture his seat.
Even though I believe, isn't it true that Cindy Axne, the only county she won in that district was Polk County?
It's a very big county.
Yep.
lot of voters.
It's sort of like the 2nd District in Johnson County. If you win Johnson County, you got a good chance of winning the whole district.
Great dovetail. Let's talk about the 2nd District. Since we last talked, Dave Loebsack has announced he will retire after how many years in Congress? 12, 14?
2006 was when he came in.
14 years. Who will the Democrats nominate to try to keep that 2nd District in Democratic the Democratic column? And who will the GOP nominate to try to reclaim that seat, which hasn't been held by the GOP since James Leach?
I would, if it looks like Rita Hart is going to run, I think somebody just posted that she was out in Washington meeting with some of the big wigs. I would imagine she'd be a very strong candidate. I think she made friends when she ran for lieutenant governor. I think she checks a lot of those. You know, if you want to talk electability, she checks a lot of the good boxes for that. And she's a policymaker. She's got that under her belt. I think Zach Walls just got to the state Senate. I think timing is bad for him. He said if Rita Hart doesn't run, that he will think more about it. I think it's probably too early for that. I think he's got a bright future, but I think he needs to have a little bit more legislating experience before he'd go to Congress. But I wouldn't be surprised if you see 6 or 7 candidates. Maybe Rita Hart clears the field. Maybe there's folks that won't run against her, but I would expect it to be really crowded on both sides.
It's been a long time since there's been an opportunity there. I mean, 14 years, people who dreamed of being a member of the Iowa House, or I mean the U.S. House, you know, this is their shot. So yeah, I agree. There could be a handful of candidates running. Looks like Rita Hart is the odds-on favorite for Democrats right now, but it's early. Who knows who's dreaming?
James, I know you've written about this, perhaps the others. Of course, Senator Ernst up for re-election. This will be her first re-election bid since being elected in 2014. At the time that you wrote, James, if I'm remembering your article, no really serious competitors have arrived on the scene, or are there?
No one's announced. There's lots of speculation. You know, this state auditor Rob Sand will run. He's certainly putting himself out there, attracting attention in various ways. But no one's announced yet. And I mean, Senator Ernst is going to be it'll be a tough challenge to beat her.
Why?
Well, I think she's done a good job of getting around the state, of meeting people, being accessible. She's worked across the aisle with people like Senator Gillibrand and Democrats on various issues. And when she won in 2014, I mean, she showed that she's a tough competitor and she's a strong candidate. And she's, you know, 6 years to work on that, so she's probably a stronger candidate today. Certainly will be better financed this time and have more support from the party. It's going to be hard for anybody to beat her.
Time for us to take a short break. Linda Waddington, Adam Sullivan, Todd Dorman, James Lynch on our panel from the Gazette. My co-host, Aaron Jordan. It's Pints and Politics edition of River to River at Theater Cedar Rapids. Our audience may rise and refresh your drinks. We'll be back in just a moment with more Pints and Politics.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back at Theater Cedar Rapids. It's a Pints and Politics edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with my co-host Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. We have with us on our panel political reporter James Lynch, columnists Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and Adam Sullivan of the Gazette, and an audience of political junkies with us this evening. Pints in hand, no fistfights have broken out yet. But we wanted to focus more on the Iowa legislature since its session just wrapped up a few days ago. Right, Aaron?
Right. So I wanted to ask you, you know, as usual, the legislative session is kind of a sprint to the finish, you know, with some bills coming out that perhaps didn't get as much airing as others. I wanted to ask our panel, what were some bills that kind of passed in that 11th hour that we didn't hear much about beforehand?
I would clarify, this one wasn't so much a race to the finish. It was like a race to the 50-yard line, and then they just cut it off clean.
It did. It finished a week before they're paid a per diem,
yeah.
And a week before their per diem was done, they finished up the session, right?
And what's up with that?
What's up with
leaving,
that?
Leaving money on the table. bills that we didn't hear much about until the very end? Well, there was that amendment in the HHS budget that came up like the day before it was passed that banned the use of state funds for gender reassignment or gender-affirming surgery, depending on how you want to characterize it. There were other bills that actually got a lot of hearing, but then sort of surprised us at the end, like the judicial nominating changes that, I mean, it certainly got a lot of discussion throughout the session, but then it was almost declared dead, and then in the final hours.
Yeah. So talk about that a little, because I think that was not discussed very much. How will that change our nomination process for the Iowa Supreme Court? Other courts in Iowa?
Court of Appeals, yeah.
Court of Appeals. So what's the difference now?
Well, the bar will still put 9 or 8 people on the nominating commission, and then the governor gets to appoint 9, so she has more power over the judicial nominating process. I don't know how much difference that's going to make, because I haven't gone back and looked in to see how many times people vote as blocks. You know, do the governor's appointees always vote together? Do the bar members always vote together? So it certainly gives her the ability to push through her nominees or his nominees, as the case may be in the future. But what the real impact is going to be, I don't know. It's a good example of sort of the sausage making that goes on, because they started out with a steak and ended up with sausage, really. I mean, they had to grind it up 2 or 3 times to get something that they could get 51 votes for. And sort of the 9-8 advantage that the governor has right now was the sausage they ended up with. And that was the best they could do and get 51 votes.
Well, and if you go back and look at what was said in 1962 when the constitutional amendment was put on the ballot, and that created the judicial selection system that we have that was changed. I mean, one of the key components of that is that you had a balance on the commission. You had 8 members that were picked by the governor, and they, you know, that's reflective of the concerns of a politician. And then you had these 8 that were elected by licensed lawyers in the state. And that was to reflect that these are folks that have an interest in making sure that our judicial system, our legal system, is run efficiently and correctly, and these are experts on what judges do. So now we've taken that balance and we've shifted it by 1 vote over to the political concerns. And so the core rationale behind making that constitutional change has been lost in this, unfortunately. And I don't, you know, it is a much better bill than what was first proposed, which would have been a much more radical change. But it's still in a system where the governor already has, you know, where all of her appointees on the Judicial Nominating Commission are all Republicans. And now she'll have 1 more appointment, and I think she already had quite a bit of say in what kind of judges she was going to get. The fact that they had to give her more is more of an indication about Republicans wanting to sort of change the way the Supreme Court makes decisions that they don't like, not because they wanted the people to have more say. Because their first bill didn't even let the Senate, elected by the people, confirm those nominating commission. And also, if they were concerned about what the people thought about this, they might have mentioned it during the campaign, because it wasn't mentioned during the campaign. Governor Kim Reynolds did not run on this, so.
That's my problem. You know, I'm much more skeptical of the courts than my colleagues are. I don't necessarily think that just because something's been in place for 50 years that it's a good idea. But if it needed to change, you know, we got this from a constitutional amendment. I think that we should have had a constitutional amendment to change it. And I would be absolutely open to that. But I think you need to go around the state and campaign on that. There were a couple legislators that have campaigned on this, in, you know, in safe Republican districts. There's been a couple bills over the years to do this. But it really did feel like it was just kind of sprung out. And I would say that's throughout the legislative session, and I'll probably repeat this even yet tonight, but there was ideas that I agreed with, but that I said, you know, you didn't do the hard work of going out and pitching this to the folks. You can't just do this in Polk County. This needs to happen in all 100 legislative districts to have this conversation. And even on, it's a weird situation to be in when even an idea that you like, you have to say, well, you didn't go about this the right way. But that's what we saw again and again, is that they sprung these things out and then they tried to rush them through with mixed success.
So one question, another thing that happened in kind of at the last minute was the legislature cut about $260,000 in federal money going to sex education programs offered by Planned Parenthood. And a question from the audience related to this, what's your response regarding this cut, this kind of cut that hadn't been disclosed much? And this is following the lawmakers already eliminating state funding to Planned Parenthood a couple years ago.
I guess they're making themselves very clear. We don't need no sex ed.
Well, and Linda, I'll ask you this question because I know you and I have reported on this topic, just the idea that once they did cut the state funding to Planned Parenthood, they mentioned that these other local agencies were going to take up the slack. Have you seen that to be the case?
Oh, no. No, I encourage you all, if you haven't, to look up the database of family planning providers as offered by the Department of Human Services. One of the phone numbers here in Linn County rings a typically unstaffed telephone in a surgery suite at St. Luke's. There's others that ring to therapist's office, oncology.
One was a dermatologist, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's been very sad what's happened to the family planning network since we've gone to this state-run system, because the priority was never women. The priority from the legislature was never getting access to birth control or broader family planning services. It's short-sighted, it's ideological, and it's all an attempt to attack Planned Parenthood because that's what appeals to a certain segment of the political base. And it's sad. It's sad because what we have then are kids who are gonna go to school, and one way or another they're gonna get sex ed, and they're going to be told things like their dirty toothbrushes, which is what my daughter was told at one point, that she was a dirty toothbrush if she had sex that nobody else would ever want to touch. I mean, let's be honest. Let's give the kids what they need so the kids can learn how to talk to others, like other adults in their life, about becoming more engaged in sexual activity or delaying it. And this isn't going to do it. We also have a governor who went out during the campaign and advocated for actually a pretty good plan that we would be able to access birth control over the counter at pharmacies. Basically, that we would have a statewide prescription that any adult woman could use. But when push came to shove, that same governor didn't even go out and champion that initiative. And the lawmakers didn't have the courage to go up against a small sliver of their base to put that out there. And that was the one thing that we had that could have counteracted all the bad things with family planning that's going on.
Question from our audience. Governor Reynolds excited about signing the Children's Mental Health Bill. It's been a few weeks since that happened, since that bill passed the legislature. This questioner wants to know, how will it make a difference? This was a bipartisan proposal that passed. Generally, everybody happy with it? Democrats, Republicans, Iowans? What difference will it make? The questioner wants to know.
You know, I think we had a situation where we had absolutely nothing. So the fact that we were able to put, the governor put this task force together and was able to get some type of framework in place, it was better than the vacuum that we had before. What's going to change immediately is I think you're going to see services trying to move toward what they think the legislature is going to want them to do. Those services, those types of providers, that type of information. But what's not going to happen is those groups are not going to make investments because we haven't backed the framework up with the money yet. So we're still waiting on those state resources to kind of be the incentive that's really going to make this take off. And I don't know if that's going to happen, because we also, remember, have the reforms to the adult mental health services, and we haven't funded that yet. So I think the first funding will be to those access centers, and maybe in the next round we might see something going to this children's health framework.
I wanted to shift a little bit. So one of the bills that did pass the legislature is a bill allowing sports betting in Iowa. And so far, Governor Reynolds hasn't signed that. I wanted to ask you, what do you think she's weighing, and do you think she'll sign it?
I would bet it's just a timing thing. I think that she's going to sign it. I think that, I mean, I think for one, I don't think I think she thinks it's a good bill. The gaming industry has been supportive of her in the past, as many of you know. But I think, you know, there is still a constituency in right-wing politics that is very, very averse to gaming, and I think she needs to tread lightly on it, but I think that she'll sign it for sure.
I think Adam's right. I think she'll sign it. She's never said anything indicating that she won't sign it. She has expressed a lot of concerns about addictions in other ways, alcoholism and other addictions, that might make you think that she's has some reservations. But you know, she's been asked a million times, and like I said, she's never said anything indicating that she won't sign it. A lobbyist at the Capitol told me that if she doesn't sign it, she probably better pack her own parachute the next time she flies with Gary Kirk.
Well, so far this spring, we've had major flooding on both the Missouri River in western Iowa and the Mississippi River in the Quad Cities. I believe I just heard today that FEMA has authorized more than $10 million in funding for western Iowa. And then part of the budget standing bill in Iowa would allocate, I think, $15 million in state money. Is that even close to adequate to what the needs are?
No. It's a start, but I mean, it's going to, the damage in western Iowa when they were putting that bill together, it hadn't flooded in Davenport yet, but $15 million is a drop in the bucket. it's a start, but the damage there, the original estimate was what, $1.6 billion, and that will certainly go higher. And then when you add in the flooding we've seen in Davenport in that region, it's going to be, it's going to keep going up. So it's just a start.
Well, there's always initially hope when this kind of stuff happens from local leaders, state leaders, that the federal government's going to come in and take care of this. And inevitably, they find out later that, unfortunately, that's not going to happen. And so I think, you're going to see the legislature have to come back next year and probably do a lot more than what they did this year. I don't think Governor Reynolds will be in favor of doing a bonding plan, as Chet Culver did. Although her first name doesn't rhyme with debt, so that helps. But they are gonna. The state is also has limited resources, so they're gonna have to figure out a way to create something that addresses the unmet needs and doesn't blow up the budget. And I don't know how this is also gonna be a session where they want to talk about. They're going to talk about tax cuts in an election year. They talked about corporate tax cuts. I think they're studying business taxes over the interim. It'll be interesting to see if they can balance the desire to cut taxes with whatever disaster response they have to come up with, because that's usually a pretty large chunk of money.
Mm-hmm. So there's a Medicaid town hall set for Cedar Rapids, I believe, on Friday to discuss United Healthcare's plan to exit the state program in 2 months. How are things looking for Iowa's privatized Medicaid program?
I'll start. I think one of the most disappointing things that didn't happen in this legislative session was any type of framework to overview, to provide accountability, to do anything with this Medicaid system. And I, for one, really hope the federal government steps in and does something so that we have to oversee what's happening here, because I'm really worried about the people who rely on this program, the providers who give care through this program. Iowa has never been known for high reimbursements rate generally, and all of the chaos in the upturn has just really put those providers in an even worse position than they were before.
Just imagine if they'd held town hall meetings across the state to announce that they were thinking about privatizing the system. I mean, that might have been nice. I mean, they didn't ask anybody their opinion. They just went ahead and did it. And now, everyone's seen what's happened. And Linda's right. The lack of oversight is, a big problem. I mean, we've got a program that when something goes wrong, now that it's managed by private entities, we don't have the control over what's happening like we did when it was state managed. So we can't fix it. We can only hope that someone else fixes it. And if they don't, they bail out of the system and we're in the situation that we're in now.
As we finish up this edition of Pints and Politics, I want to harken back to, being in the lobby and out
Theater Cedar Rapids in the lobby talking with others. And of course, we are in the enviable position, or unenviable, depending on how you see it, of being able to meet firsthand the 2020 presidential candidates here in Iowa. We will be doing that over the next, well, more than a half year. I'd like to get a sense of our audience here. I'm going to say, ask you how many presidential candidates you've already met. Stop clapping when we have reached your limit or exceeded your limit, just to get a sort of audio idea of how much engagement you are having face-to-face with our 20-some presidential candidates. Todd, you look skeptical. Is this going to work?
No, I'm on the edge of my seat.
Okay, how many 2020 presidential candidates have you seen in person? Stop clapping when we've exceeded the number that you've seen. Have you seen at least one? Have you seen at least two? At least three? At least four? At least five? At least six? At least seven? At least eight? At least nine? At least 10, at least 11, at least 12, gentlemen's going on back there, at least 13, at least 14. Beware, we're in the era of fake news, so I'm not sure. Okay, we'll give it to the gentleman back there, at least 14, very good. We want to wind up here by honoring our panelist who will depart this panel. We're mourning it. We're shocked. We wish her all the best. Linda Waddington here. Yeah. We want all those well-deserved accolades, Linda. We will miss you so much.
Thank you.
Your fans who read your columns religiously. Let's go around and ask, as a final question to the rest of the panelists, and perhaps finishing up with you, Linda, the question is, what will Linda Waddington most miss about Pints and Politics?
Oh.
Who wants to jump in first? Okay, Adam Sullivan.
I know I'm sarcastic a lot, but this is genuine. In my mind, Linda is kind of a fashion icon, and... She dresses well every day, but I think she dresses a little bit special for Pints and Politics, and I think maybe she'll miss that.
Jim, what will Linda Waddington most miss about Pints and Politics in your estimation?
The audience, yeah. Her fans.
Todd Dorman?
Well, I mulled this over. I thought free beer was probably, that's sort of crass. And mostly I've been thinking about how I'm the insights editor, and now I'm going to have a lot fewer insights. So it's a huge insight deficit. So that's going to be a problem. So, but I think what, and this is kind of an inside joke, but it's kind of funny. I think what she's going to miss is just being reminded periodically that our founding fathers drank pints and talked politics. Every time we chuckle at that. Because,
Is it getting to be a bit of a tired phrase? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
here's your chance.
Or
that it only includes one gender.
I will tell you that before we left the office to come over here, Todd Dorman was very worried he might have to give a testimonial.
Well, now let me get started. Yeah. This is a solemn occasion.
But I will also make two confessions. One is every time we talk about the founding fathers, I have threatened to have a loom or something that I pull from under the table to begin to show what the founding mothers might have done. The past few months, I have decided that the founding mothers were in the kitchen actually writing and planning everything.
Yes.
Very good.
The second confession, which I didn't plan on making tonight, but I think is very important. Folks around the Gazette know, and I think some of the IPR people know, coming out on stage and doing this event for me every time was a challenge. Like to the point of sickness challenge, that I was so nervous to come out here. And that includes tonight, maybe especially tonight. So I guess what I would like to leave you with is, the adage is do things that scare you. This has been challenging and incredibly rewarding. And I am so happy to have spent time with all of you. Thank you.
And that was Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening at Theater Cedar Rapids. My co-host was Gazette reporter Aaron Jordan. Our panelists, Adam Sullivan, Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and James Lynch, all of the Gazette. By the way, this was Linda Waddington's last Pints and Politics. Yep, she's leaving her position as a columnist for the Gazette to take a job at Tanager Place, a regional nonprofit with a focus on children's mental health. We will miss Linda tremendously. The next Pints and Politics is scheduled for Thursday, June 20th at Big Grove in Iowa City. Our producer and audio editor today, Emily Woodbury. Our sound engineer, Jim Davies. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a wonderful weekend.